Welcome and thank you for joining today's conference, What Matters Now? Finding an alternative income source to the increasingly risky bond market. I'm joined today by Ross Taylor, partner and portfolio manager, and Tom Winnick, the head of business development at ARS. All audio lines have been muted. Please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box and press send. Questions will be addressed during the Q&A portion of this call. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historical facts are subject to a number of risk and uncertainty. Actual results may differ materially. Please refer to ARS's website for important legal and disclosure information. With that, I will turn the call over to Tom Winnick.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and good afternoon, everyone. As we have written about in several of our outlooks, central banks globally have worked in concert to provide an unbelievable level of accommodative monetary policy. From interest rates in the United States being near zero to several economies in Europe having negative interest rates, it is something that just 20 years ago we couldn't have predicted or even fathomed. Couple this monetary policy with government's fiscal policy of spend, 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 and the result has been staggering levels of debt. With the need to service this debt and the fragility of economies globally, central bankers are not eager to raise rates anytime soon, as Fed Chairman Powell and several other Federal Reserve Bank members have stated. This environment of low interest rates has spurred investors to go on a search for yield. In fixed income, there are really four ways to find yield or to achieve higher yield. You can go out and buy longer maturity bonds. So instead of, for instance, buying a 10-year bond, you may go out to 30 years. And Ross will touch on why there's some pitfalls to this. You could buy lower quality bonds, i.e. junk bonds, or you could decide to use leverage or derivatives. None of these, we believe, are ideal. We feel the ARS core equity strategy provides investors with an alternative to a traditional fixed income-only portfolio. We started the portfolio 10 years ago in 2011 to address the issue of rising bond yields, which were negatively affecting the portfolio of one of our institutional clients. The solution is a conservative equity portfolio which pays an attractive dividend yield and that may also provide growth to portfolios. If we were sitting in March of 2011 and I told you we would provide you with a portfolio that would, in the next 10 years, earn about 11% per year net of fees with less risk of the S&P 500 and an attractive dividend yield, I think we might all sign up for that strategy. Well, that's been what the core equity strategy at ARS has been. If you take a look at the types of characteristics of the companies that we hold in the core equity strategy, we're really looking for companies that are high quality with high barriers to entry in the industries that they operate in, good and talented management teams, a strong balance sheet with reasonable earnings growth, and above average portfolio dividend yields, of course. The strategy will generally hold about 35 names. As I just mentioned, if you go to the next slide, that slide, Sarah, thank you. As I spoke about earlier, the long-term results have been favorable versus the S&P 500. Last year, however, was a difficult year in many ways, and it was a difficult year for the core equity strategy. Investors didn't trust that companies would continue to pay their dividends and capital flow to those companies that were benefiting from the shutdown. If you take a look at our up-down capture pre-pandemic, meaning from inception until December of 2019, you see that ARS had an up capture of 83% and down capture of 60%. And put another way, if the S&P 500 was up in a particular time period of 10%, generally our strategy was up 8.3%. Conversely, if the S&P 500 was down 10%, our strategy would be down about 6%. If you take a look at 2020, that up-down capture was kind of turned on its head, as we were only able to achieve 78% of the up, with just about essentially all of the down at 97%. We're happy to report, however, that the ARS Core Equity Strategy during the reopening, since the beginning of the year essentially, has returned to pre-pandemic levels and actually even improved on those a bit with an 88% up and 58% down capture. So if you took a look at the next page, you'll see the actual holdings of the portfolio as of March 31st, 2021, with many of the names that you see here being household names and all of these being dividend payers. With that, what we'd like to do is turn to Ross Taylor and talk more specifically about the portfolio itself. Why are we excited about the core strategy at this point, Ross?
Thank you, Tom. We look at the current market environment and what this strategy is designed to do, as you laid it out, which is to produce a yield above that of the S&P 500 while allowing investors to participate in a substantial portion of any bull market upside and significantly reduce the investment exposure to bear markets. And we feel that this is a portfolio that is today very well positioned to do what it is supposed to do. And this is because, as you also mentioned, there's a focus on high-quality companies with strong management teams, strong balance sheets, and good and sustainable free cash flows. And it's also because we've been able to build a portfolio that has exposure to areas that we feel are going to be winners in both the near term and also in the longer term. And a glance at this page shows you that. You see that we're overweighted in industrials and defense. We're overweighted in information technology, financials, and also real estate. And we'll talk more about our specific approach to the real estate investment. And while we're underweight in the consumer and communication sectors, some of which is because of the low dividend yields. When we first put this strategy together, we decided that rather than focus, as many do, on a dividend yield for the portfolio as a whole, we would focus on the dividend paid by each individual company and our expectations about whether or not they will be able to grow that dividend over time. This means that instead of having built a high yield, low quality portfolio, which you often find in income-oriented products that could rocket in certain environments, perhaps like the one that we're currently in, but would struggle in many others, we've built a portfolio that we believe is expected to perform in almost every kind of market environment, in no small part because the companies we're invested in are well exposed to the long-term themes that we have been advancing in our outlook, while also having exposure to many of the nearer-term ones that are driving the current market.
Okay, so that gives us an idea why you like this portfolio for equity investors. But what about those who prefer to run a balanced or bond-heavy portfolio?
Well, first, let me say that anytime you talk about bonds, you're talking about something that's a very simple concept, but actually can become quite confusing for people who have to listen to you talk about them because there's a lot of lingo and not a little math that goes into talking about bonds. So I'm going to apologize right at the start for using phrases like basis points. And for reference, a basis point is simply 1/100th of 1%. Getting back to our core strategy versus fixed income, what we have found is that for many and maybe most of those clients we have invested in this strategy, a big part of what they're concerned about is how the strategy does measure up against fixed income. For those investors, one part of what should make this type of strategy attractive is its dividend yield, which is at 2.2%, well above that of either the S&P 500 or the 10-year Treasury. If you want to step back a little bit and take maybe a little bit more risk and look at long-dated government bonds, what you'll find, or government bonds, we're talking about 1.14, but then you move into long-dated investment grade, which is BBB minus or better corporate bonds. And you'll find that they do have a somewhat superior yield, 2.6%, if you go out 10 years. When you start to look at these things, you realize that if you want to own a treasury security and get a 2.2 yield, you have to go out about 20 years, which is a substantial amount of time. if you look at things, one of the things we like and why we like equities versus bonds is that equities not only pay dividends, but historically they grow those dividends. And in fact, in 27 of the last 30 years, the dividend paid by the S&P 500 has actually gone up. When you figure that over that same 30-year period, it's gone up by an average of 6%, which means that your dividend yield doubles every 12 years. You can see when it comes to generating income for our investors, our core strategy, we believe, offers real advantages against either treasuries or investment-grade corporates. And while the income produced by the bond is going to be limited to whatever the coupon it pays you when you buy it, as I said, the fact that the stocks that make up the S&P 500 have a long history of meaningfully increases their dividends. And in fact, that dividend increase is about 150% of the level of inflation over the last 30 years. We think that this makes this a very attractive investment. And in particular, for the first time in many decades, we feel bonds no longer are sailing with the wind at their back, while the core strategy we're talking about here might well be.
Well, we hear, Ross, from investors and even some clients that bonds are safe or even riskless. I'll bet you have some thoughts on that.
Well, a number of years ago, I testified in front of Congress on risk in investment assets. And let me say it was interesting. The politicians that I was speaking to only saw one type of risk in investment assets, and that was loss of principal or sustained loss of principal. And therefore, they thought bonds were not only the safest investment, but perhaps the only investment appropriate for federal paper or for federal trust funds. But what I pitched back to them was that a bond only protects you against one type of risk, and that's a sustained loss of principal. But to get that risk protection, you have to absorb a number of other types of risk that are probably long run much greater to you. The foremost being the loss of purchasing power and the loss of principal in periods of rising rates. And while it's our current belief that inflation will not grow on a sustained basis in a substantial manner, it is going to grow. That means that, as I said before, we're getting into a whole new ballgame with fixed income investments, one that we haven't seen in decades. And yes, the highly accommodative Fed and the Congress that you were talking about, Tom, will reduce the chance that there'll be any major level of defaults in corporate bonds, as it appears that neither of those bodies is really all that interested in choking off the rebirth of moderately higher inflation at this time. Those who invest in fixed income are going to have to pay the price for how that decision impacts their bond portfolio. And you have to add to that the fact that we do believe that moving forward, the Fed is going to start tapering its bond purchase program, which will only make the situation worse for bondholders. Put another way, for a variety of reasons, we believe that bond prices are likely to be declining, not yields, but prices in coming years. And then we think that it's unrealistic for the real yield to remain at its current 100 basis points forever. And the real yield is the difference between what you get in a 10-year treasury versus what the inflation rate is at this point in time. And that means that long-term rates, long-term interest rates, are going to move higher in coming years. And as we say in my house, math is inexorable. And this chart here shows you the inexorability of that math. This is the 20-year treasury going back to 2011. And what you see is that where it started around 95, 100, it moved up to over 170 last summer. But since last summer, when long rates peaked, 100 basis point move in the 10-year has resulted in that moving from about 172 down to around 136. And that ends up being something in the neighborhood of a 20% drop in value for a 20-year treasury bond. If you roll it back and say, well, you're not going to buy a 20-year, you're instead looking at buying a 10-year. A 10-year bond that today yields 2%, let's say it's some sort of good quality corporate bond. If you hold that bond and decide in 2 years for some reason you need to actually sell it, and interest rates have moved from the current 2% to 4%, whoever buys that bond from you is going to demand that 4% yield to maturity. And since your bond's only paying them 2% in interest each year, they're going to get the rest of that 4% out of principal, which means that for every $100 of bonds you sell to them, they're only going to pay you $86, which is a 14% drop in value on a 200 basis point move in interest rates over the next couple of years. And the only way you're going to get that principal back is if you hold that bond until it matures or rates drop meaningfully enough to bring it back in line. So while we do recognize that rates could fall somewhat, they're only 100 basis points off their all-time low. And as we said, you know, treasuries are only at about 160 basis points. So there is some downside. If we go back to the all-time low in bonds, you're only going to make about 7.5% on that 10-year bond. So as this time, we see what we would consider to be an asymmetrical risk in bonds between upside, downside. We see, you know, significant downside risk in bond prices. We see low yield, we see low expected absolute returns, and we see a significant risk of exposure to either inflation or the removal of a negative real rate of interest. So I think that puts out where we kind of fall out in this circumstance with regard to fixed income.
Okay, but what's an investor to do then?
Well, the first thing I would say is we would like investors, we counsel investors to look at all of your income producing assets with what I would call intellectual consistency. And by that, I mean, if you're looking at bonds and taking a long-term view of bonds, let's say you're saying, well, I can hold this bond for 10 years to maturity. You need to take a long-term view of your equity portfolio. What we have found is that while people are quite comfortable ignoring losses, short-term losses in their bond portfolio, they don't view their equity the same way. And in fact, it's not uncommon for people to look at equities on a quarterly, monthly, or even daily basis. And when prices move against them, they become increasingly concerned and they often feel that there's a need to protect their principal. And that means that they, when they're moving to protect, which is code language for saying they want you to sell or raise cash, what they're actually doing is taking away the best friend you have as an investor, which is time. And we have found that historically, taking that factor away results in what I might call suboptimal decision making. What few people understand is that equities as an asset class rarely put together two down years in a row and are almost equally unlikely to generate a negative return over any two-year rolling period. So one of the first things we do is say, give stocks more respect when it comes to their ability to sustain the value of your principal over time. On the macro level, we think that stocks offer you the best portfolio potential right now for income generation if you look forward 3 to 5 years because of the factor I mentioned earlier, which is not only are you getting a better than bond yield today in many cases, but you're also going to see those dividends grow with time. And we think that because of the nature of the businesses that we're investing here, which are high quality companies and the like, very well managed businesses, we think that you're likely going to see appreciation in the core of your assets, not only the income. So when you look at what we own as a summary, what you see is that this is a portfolio that's currently trading at about a 15% discount to the S&P 500's PE for 2021, almost a 17% discount to next year's, meaning we're trading at 19 versus over 22 and under 17 versus 20 for next year. We have a better cash flow yield, which means our businesses turn more of their profits into cash than the market as a whole. We have a cheaper price to sales. And what to me is most telling here is you're buying this lower PE, higher free price to cash flow ratio portfolio, which has historically generated a significantly better return on equity than the market, and return on equity is when a company reinvests its capital in its business. And what the companies in this portfolio have done historically is generate about a 26% return on every dollar they put back into their business versus the market's 23%. So when you look at all of these factors, I think what you see is equity is the place that income-oriented investors need to be rotating and thinking about in a very hard way when they're facing reinvesting bonds that are maturing in this current environment or putting new money to work that they hope to raise income out of.
All right, Ross, that's a good snapshot of where we are today. Can you describe and talk a little bit about the risk-reward characteristics of the portfolio over the last 10 years?
Certainly, Tom. And I think you covered this pretty well in your lead-in. But the portfolio has historically been able to capture more than 80% of the S&P 500's total return while exposing it less to 75% of the market's downside. And that includes the impact of what you commented, I think correctly, was an aberrational performance in 2020. As you mentioned, it struggled a bit against our historic expectations. And that was because of the very unique nature of last year, where about half of the S&P 500's total return was generated by a mere handful of companies, literally five or six companies that had low or no dividends, had high growth and high valuations, which turned some of the highest priced stocks in the market into names that investors thought of as defensive investments. And I've been in this business for a while, but I do not ever recall a time when the highest priced segment of the market were seen as the safest names in the stock market. Also, performance last year was hurt by the investor concern about the ability of companies to sustain, let alone grow their dividends. And bank stocks were hurt because the Fed imposed a moratorium on increasing dividends or buying back stock. And that combined together led investors to leave this space. Now, none of the negatives turned out to be the case, which should be something that's seen as very positive going forward. And this year, as you mentioned, we're seeing a return to the strong operating environment that's driving not only top line beats, but also substantial bottom line beats on earnings per share, cash flow, and other factors. And we believe that this is going to allow many companies to meaningfully increase their dividends this year. And that is why we think the strategy has moved back to the kind of returns that we expect out of it relative to the market. And as this chart shows you, historically, you know, we've been able to track fairly close to the market, getting, you know, roughly, as you said, over 80% of the returns while having a significantly lower risk, which is, we believe, attractive for income-oriented investors.
Very good. Now, if we turn, Ross, to some of the companies specific in the portfolio, I know we have a couple of investments that are uniquely positioned in the 5G space. Can you give us your thoughts on those names?
Certainly. First, we believe that one of the most important aspects of the current Biden infrastructure plan is the allocation of resources it makes to meaningfully improve the availability of high-speed internet to all Americans. Those of you who've listened to prior calls have heard us talk about how 5G is going to fuel everything from faster internet for education and personal use to autonomous driving and factory automation. For technical and scientific reasons, the current network of tower and cable infrastructure that provides the backbone for 4G wireless communications is far from adequate to cope with the needs and demands that 5G is going to place on it as we move ahead. Because of this, we think that the companies that currently control the grid and those that offer the ability to effectively and efficiently upgrade broadcast networks so that they can go deeper, broader, and are more robust are going to be the true winners as we move forward into the world of Internet of Everything. This means that we're going to need more towers and more equipment placed on the towers in the field to create a denser pattern than our current network provides. And we think this could lead to a sort of land rush for tower and transmitter space. Because without a much broader infill of the current network, we're not going to be able to get anywhere near what we want and expect out of 5G. To this end, we were able to take advantage of weakness in this space last year on investor concerns that to establish positions in two names, one of which is American Tower and the other is Uniti. We believe that the assets that these two companies have, American Tower, and you see here in the map, the red is areas where they have tower coverage. And you see how dense that is in the Northeast and the Midwest, upper Midwest and the like, and also along the West Coast, but how empty it is in the middle of the country. And we feel that, you know, that asset is an irreplaceable asset. And we think that that network is something that very few other people have. There's really one major competitor to them in this space. Think of the company as a sort of REIT for towers. And they own the towers, they control the real estate, they have the ability to infill because they're going to be infilling between tower setups they already have. They have sites and the technology capabilities, to do all of this. They have the resources to be effective in hardening their sites to threats, be they climactic or criminal. And we believe that there's effectively no way for a new player not in this space to enter the space. And while we do think that certain technologies such as LEO or low Earth orbiting satellites can augment and will be needed to augment this network, all you have to do is looking at this chart to see how much white shows up in the Mountain West and the Great Plains to know that we need to do a better job, and that's going to end up being covered by alternatives to cell towers. We know that we don't think there's anything that can at this time replace the use of the cell tower for transmitting things across the airwaves, wireless communication. The second name that we were talking about is Unity. And Unity has what one might call pipelines. Pipelines has a bad connotation perhaps now, but they have fiber optic networks that link major markets and major communication centers and the like. Because what you're really doing is when you call on your cell phone, you're calling the towers, and the towers bounce the signal along until it can get to someplace where it gets into a fiber optic network for rapid transmission. You know, fiber optics work at the speed of light. And therefore, what we see here in Unity is the ability to pull markets together. I mean, with the Unity network, you can literally go from everywhere from Portland to LA to Miami to Dallas to New York to Chicago. You know, you can literally cover the entire country with that, with high-speed data transmission and the like. And we believe that that is also a very unique asset that is not widely understood by people, but it's essential as we move forward, because as we push more data into the system, we're going to rely more and more on fiber optic transmission to move that data through the system to its intended targets. So, you know, as I said, we were very fortunate to be able to establish positions, we feel, in those these two names, you know, during the internet COVID pandemic shutdown and the loss of faith in some of these investments at that time.
Okay, thank you, Ross. Most of the Wall Street strategists are expecting rapid economic growth as we exit the pandemic restrictions. One of the big beneficiaries, the thinking goes, is going to be transportation, with goods needing to be moved from ports to factories and factories to stores and to ultimately consumers. We see the advantages that railroads have here. And can you talk about that in this environment?
Certainly. As you're saying, one of the biggest issues confronting the nation in its bounce back from the COVID-induced shutdowns of last year has been the difficulty in moving the goods that are demanded by the reopening from factories or docks to those who distribute them, and in the end, to those at the end market. This backlog exists for a number of reasons, but it became apparent to us last year that for our economy to effectively reopen, we were going to need to move a whole lot of goods a lot faster and much more efficiently than we've ever moved them before. Now, to date, this has not really happened. Ports are still backlogged, with dozens of ships waiting offshore at many of the West Coast ports. Cargo containers are in such short supply that the prices have basically tripled. In some cases, that's because cargo containers got shipped into, you know, third world markets during COVID, and literally they haven't come back out at this point in time. So there's a real shortage of them. So we need to be able to get these containers, which are the primary way goods and services are moved from Asia to the United States, off of ships rapidly and into the distribution network, which means they need to be hauled by rail cars and trucks. And now what Union Pacific does is it's one of two major players in the only two West Coast railroads, the other being the Burlington Northern. By dint of history, Union Pacific basically covers the southern part of the United States, focused on Long Beach, Los Angeles, but they do go all the way up to Seattle, where the other railroad, Burlington Northern, which is owned by Warren Buffett, covers the northern tier of the United States. But this map shows you that if there are bottlenecks on West Coast ports, Union Pacific can still benefit even if shippers move their goods into the Gulf of Mexico, you know, the Texas coast, New Orleans. The Union Pacific network runs from LA to Seattle to Milwaukee to New Orleans. It gets you up and down the Mississippi River and gets you pretty much to all points in between. So we believe that it's an essential way to unclog the bottleneck that's currently choking the flow of goods from overseas. And as might seem evident, but isn't always, railroads are really, there's no competition. No one is going to greenfield. No one's going to build a new railroad in this country. And in addition, while railroads are thought of as old fashioned and kind of passe, they are actually the greenest way to move heavy loads in the United States at this point in time, and the most cost efficient way to move them on a per ton basis. So we think that right now, everything kind of leans in favor of a Union Pacific as we work our way out of the current, clogged bottlenecks we have in the distribution of goods and services as we reopen the economy.
Another name that's somewhat related, surprisingly, to the pandemic clearly accelerating the push towards e-commerce is a name we believe is well positioned. Can you talk a little bit about Blackstone here?
Certainly, and I will agree with you, Tom, that when one thinks about e-commerce, Blackstone is not the first name that comes to mind for me. But this is seen as an investment company. It's private capital, it's hedge funds, it's leveraged lending, and it's real estate. It's very big in real estate. And when we started to dig into the logistics side, the idea of, Union Pacific moves goods across the country and they move them from, let's say, a port to a distribution center, that's considered the logistics chain. And the distribution center is the important hub in the logistics chain where goods are offloaded and then broken up and shipped to a variety of other locations. And our research showed us that Blackstone is often the owner and partner in the largest logistics networks in this country. We're a little surprised to see that, they are a geographically diverse in the U.S., but also globally. They are part owners of the largest operation, logistics operation in China. They have operations throughout the Pacific Rim and in Europe. So they give you that massive exposure, that broad exposure. But what we really like about them is they view their business like we view ours, which is to be early, find opportunities, invest their money wisely at places where people haven't yet started to move. So prices aren't being driven up. And then they take a very portfolio manager's approach. When someone comes in and wants to buy them out of an asset, they will sell it if the price that people are offering exceeds what they feel it's worth, and if they believe they can put that money to good use. And history says Blackstone is very good at putting it to good use. So a number of years ago, they started to push money into industrial sites. They pushed money into logistics sites, and they were pulling money out of other areas that they felt were less attractive. And so what we have found with Blackstone is an exceptionally well-managed company with an exposure to where we want to have it have exposure to, but also where it, as well as we, are watching trends and watching opportunities and moving away from things that they no longer feel offer attractive upside and risk reward. So it's a pretty exciting company for us.
Very good. And finally, we've been hearing quite a bit about the semiconductor chip shortage. 60 Minutes just ran a segment just a week or two ago. And I know we have two investments in the portfolio, which should have a nice tailwind. Can you talk about those two?
Those two are KLA Corp, which we call CLAC, and Lam Research. This is one of the places, the sectors where the focus on us in this strategy of having every company pay a dividend actually has paid a dividend in and of itself. Anyone who knows us knows that we really believe in the long-term story for memory and semiconductor chips. But when the pandemic hit, very few of the companies in the chip space paid a dividend. And many of those did either paid a de minimis dividend or cut the dividend or eliminated the dividend that they were paying. So this left us with a difficult way to participate in what we think is one of the most powerful trends in the market, in the economy at this point in time, which is the demand for more semiconductors, more chips, more memory. So we went looking for ways we could participate in that space. And we found in that effort the fact that we could go to these companies, that they're CLACs and the Lambs and a handful of other companies, that actually gave us a very interesting return. And we thought that the market was valuing incorrectly, because historically, these companies have been cyclical plays on a cyclical industry, meaning that the semiconductor industry was an industry full of short cycles. their demand would spike, prices would go up, they would overbuild, they'd and produce, and then everything would crash down. And what would happen is the semiconductor equipment companies would benefit as things were going up. And then as they crashed down, the semiconductor companies themselves, those who make the semiconductors or fab them, were cutting down on investment in capital equipment. So the Clacks and the Lambs of the world would see this rapid roller coaster of good times, bad times, just as the semiconductors would. But we think that that has changed. And we think no small part because what we've now done is created in both the semiconductor space and the semiconductor capital equipment space, what is really a monopoly or oligopolistic market environment, where there, in both cases, there are really only a handful of players. There are also an equally small number of suppliers, and those suppliers have taken an effort to specialize by unique skill set. And so right now, it's exceptionally hard for a new company not in this space to break into it because they're unproven. And all they can really offer generally is a lower price. But when you're talking about equipment that costs tens of millions of dollars to hundreds of millions of dollars being put into new fabs or fabrication facilities that cost billions of dollars. And you're looking at a situation where a business doesn't want to take that kind of risk. They make a good enough return on their investment that it's not worth it for them to take the slightly lower cost alternative if someone could develop it. It's also right now simply too risky for the big players, the Intels and the Taiwan Semis and the Microns and the others, to make a bet on this kind of unproven player, because not only does it cost a lot to build one of these systems, it takes months to get one built. I mean, this is like building an airliner or a ship or a submarine or something of that nature. You put the order in now and you're not getting it in the near future. It's going to take you time. And so any shortfall, any mistake that happens has such a dislocating effect down the entire chain that companies aren't willing to really to go after and change these things. Clacks and Lambs, they are allowed to make a good return on their invested capital because there's simply no other alternative. So what we see now is a space where we got a highly correlated supply and demand prospect. Everyone has heard about the chip shortage, and that shortage exists not just in new high-end chips. It also exists in older chips that are getting more and more use because, like many things, you think about it the way you think about a car. As a new technology gets introduced into a car, it goes into the highest end car. If you're looking at a Mercedes, it goes into the S500s or the AMG models. And over time, it finds its way into the lowest model. What's happening is the Internet of Things is driving demand for old chips that were thought to be on their way out to help drive things from, your doorbell camera, your smart thermostat, your smart refrigerator. All these things are making use of that. So there's a demand for what's old, and that needs, that capacity needs to grow. At the same time, there's a demand for modern and up-to-date stuff that really needs to drive forward. So we think we're in a situation where we're going to see sustained performance. We're not saying it's no longer a cyclical industry, but we're saying it's now an industry with a long cycle or a super cycle that's going to help drive it forward and make these attractive names for years to come. I'll pass it back to you, Tom.
Great, Ross. Thank you very much. That concludes our prepared remarks. As Sarah mentioned earlier, please, if you have any questions, there's a Q&A box which you can type the questions into, and we'd be happy to answer them. As Ross and I have laid out here, we're in a challenging environment in terms of folks looking for yield. We think that the core equity strategy may be a solution. Again, with 75% of the risk of the S&P 500 and getting at a 2.2% yield, 135% of the yield of the 10-year treasury, we think it may be a viable solution. So please don't hesitate to reach out to ARS if we can help you in any way in your search for yield. So I don't see any questions at this point. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to us directly, and we will answer them directly with you. So thank you all very much for joining us and making time in your schedules today. Enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks very much for your business.